Yeah, one of your organizers over there was living with some of them over there, I think.
Probably.
Yeah.
But you know, now it's changed. You know, they still hang around. You know, but they know that.
They know that you know.
Yeah.
That's good.
The kids pride it everywhere.
Huh?
They pride it everywhere.
Are they down there too?
They used to in the college area.
Oh yeah, that's right.
This is.
Yeah.
We said goodbye to him in Sacramento.
One of our former organizers in the farm workers union was one of them up there.
Is that right? Well, we told them where to go in Santa Rosa. And, they didn't want
to. Yeah, I heard that. Levy told me that you did a job on them up there.
You know, they really didn't, you know, it was kind of like they were sitting there and they all looked at each other like, you know, well, who's the leader, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And this girl, you know, she decided. So, well, you stay. Since there are no more leaders here, you stay so I can talk to you. Maybe you know about the whole thing. And everybody is split, you know, from the group.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, they're going to stay with her. And the other people, I said, goodbye, goodbye. And then the other people stood there with her. I said, now I know who the group is.
Mm-hmm.
I said, none of them were, you know, willing to, you know, come out in the open and say, well, we're part of the whole group. They all kind of looked at each other, and the girl, the woman said, yeah, I am. He stayed, and they all stayed. Boom. I did what Jesus, you know, told me to do all along, you know, trying to fuck me over. They just cut their own necks, you know.
Yeah.
They just, you know, what they were doing was they were, you know, they made several mistakes, but what they were doing is they were politicking within the group.
Sure.
And they cut their own necks when the workers or whatever rejected the goddamn letter that they didn't know what the hell, you know, the letter said.
Yeah.
They knew what it might say, and then when I told them, they said, well, there's nothing wrong with the letter. I said, oh yeah. You know, then maybe you're smarter than I am. You know, I speak Spanish and read Spanish and read that goddamn letter to me. Well, he said, I don't read Spanish. And goddamn it, how do you know that this goddamn letter says what you think it says? You're so goddamn smart and intelligent. You know, how can you let a person like myself without no goddamn education tell you that, you know?
Yeah.
So they got really stymied, you know? They said, well, what are you trying to tell us? It's very simple. You do what we tell you to do, not what you want to tell us what to do.
Right.
You get the fuck off. You follow orders. You follow the farm workers' policy, the executive board. That's it.
Yeah.
You kicking us out,
man?
Do you want it any clearer than that?
Yeah.
You follow our rules,
yeah.
And that's the name of the game. Yeah. You're like, get the hell out.
Yeah.
She started
crying.
It's
the only way.
Out. The only way?
Yeah.
He's out of there.
Yeah. Are there any other questions about that period between the personal visit and the house meeting? If there aren't, I want to get on to at least the beginning of the house meeting itself. As I mentioned last night, or sometime yesterday, it's very important, I think, for you to be there a little early. Get to the meeting early. So that you have another shot at talking to the host or the hostess. And since you know him or her, you can, you know, ask him to help you if you need any help in convincing the people that are going to come to help out in the campaign. And you can do that. You know the people. say, maybe I won't need any help, but if I do, I hope you'll pitch in and give me a hand. And by being there early, very often, people come in by ones and twos, you know, one at a time. And you'll be able to talk to them ahead of time when they come in. Find out a little bit more about them so that you can use that information during the house meeting. And if they're working, you find out where they work. And both, you know, not only the farm workers, but the older people, as you said, some of them work, and you want to know. You want to know where they work, because you'll be using that during the meeting. If you happen to know that there are people coming to that meeting from a fairly sympathetic ranch, in other words, a ranch, you know what I mean, where there are a lot of workers that are fairly sympathetic toward the United Farm Workers, or else they're former members or whatever, that's a good thing to know ahead of time, so that you can talk about that ranch during the meeting and get more information from him. Maybe get, by knowing that, you can get him to help or her to help on that particular ranch in whatever it is you want to do, and especially on this Teamster thing. And by the time you have that first house meeting, you should definitely have your leaflets. So you'll come to the house meeting equipped with leaflets, explaining the services of the house meeting, explaining the Gallo campaign, and you'll also come with your house meeting outline. And don't be afraid to use it, because that's much better than, you know, stumbling all over the waterfront because you've forgotten what to say next and so forth. You've got the outline right there. Remember when Caesar first started organizing? He was in Oakland, and he never actually held a house meeting before. Although he'd watched me hold a lot of them, he didn't write very well, but he managed to. Eventually, he learned to type so that he could type much faster than he could write. But in the beginning, he had a hard time writing out his outline, but he did it. And so he'd come in, he'd sit down, he'd have the outline next to him, maybe on a little side table next to his chair, with an ashtray. He used to smoke in those days. And so every once in a while, he'd be smoking, you know, and he'd forget what he was going to say next, and he'd, you know, pretend like he was just knocking off some ashes, and he'd see what came next on his outline there while he was knocking the ashes off. But, you know, he had to, because he was full of, you know, what they call stage fright when he was first giving those. Well, you folks have all been, you know, most of you have been through the mill, you're not going to have much stage fright. Except Elena, of course, she's very timid. and then you want to have you certainly want to have a pad to get the names, addresses, and telephone numbers, if they have them, of all the people that are there. And so you pass around the pad and get there, explain to them that you need their names, telephone number, your addresses and telephone numbers, because probably if things go well, you'll be getting out a newsletter, which is very probably what you will do. If you're going to have an organization out there, you've got to have some way of communicating with the members and keeping them up to date on some of the things that are going on. And undoubtedly, some of you already have a newsletter that you get out once a month. So, well, that's only one of the reasons. Naturally, if you want to get the names, address, and telephone numbers, you're going to use that for a lot of things. And one of the first things you're going to use it for is to learn their names so that at the meeting you can start calling them by their names. And that's the easiest way to learn the names. just send that pad around, it comes back to you, and you can look at the pad and look at the face every time somebody talks, and pretty quick you're addressing them by their names, and they're amazed at the fact that you've learned their name, and that makes them feel pretty good. You know, it's a little gimmick, but it's very, very, very useful, because by knowing people's names, it makes them feel just a little bit more important than they did if you didn't know their names. In other words, if they're just somebody that's sitting there, you don't ever call them by their names, they don't, you know, they don't particularly, they don't feel too important, and it makes people feel good to feel important. That's what we want to do, is make people feel good, get them in the mood for what we're going to be talking about. About the idea of when you're going to start the meeting, this is another problem that comes up. Because there's always people that are late. And yet, you can't... With the farm workers especially that have to get up so early, you can't keep them waiting and waiting and waiting there for those last couple of people to come. So you've got to start the meeting pretty much on time. I wouldn't wait more than 15 minutes from the time that meeting is scheduled to start. I go ahead and start it. At the end of 15 minutes, I'd start the meeting. And then, if people come in within the next 10 minutes, you know, you can... very quickly, with a few words, just tell them, you know, how far you've gone, what you've covered, and then go on with it. Don't go back and repeat the whole thing, because that just drives people up the wall. They don't want to. It gets monotonous and boring. If they come in much later than 15 minutes, or certainly if they come in after half an hour has gone by, then I just tell them when they come in, well, I'll after the meeting's over, well, I'll tell you what I've already been talking about, because you certainly can't go back and bring them up to date on everything you've covered in a half hour. These are just little things that you have to you ought to be ready for at each house meeting. I don't think that I'll go any further into the discussion of the house meeting right now. Other than maybe I will. We've still got about 10 minutes. We're going to eat at 5 o'clock again? Okay. I think right now we'll pass out the house meeting outline.
Does anybody know where the attendance record is that I went passing around? Has everybody signed it?
No.
Okay.
Let me check it.
Will you give me a break, I guess? Let me just start picking up some.
Yeah, I'm just
going to speak
to you about it.
Oh.
There's some names on there,
No.
How is it we get our names?
I did.
Oh, that classy.
That's the first time Jennings ever done.
Well, that was funny.
You didn't spill money.
You misjudged me, didn't you?
But that was funny.
You didn't spill money.
I can't see at all in here.
Sophia?
My emphysema hit me.
Okay, now, I'm not sick. didn't know that you would come and get stuff for. Who doesn't have one? I've got a baby I didn't have. Does everybody have one?
Okay. You notice what we've done with the one house meeting, the Greeny, is the general house meeting that we've been using all over, house meeting outline that we've been using all over the United States and Canada, out in the boycott. Before we began to concentrate on Gallo. In other words, at the time the Green House Meeting outline was put together, we were working on all three of them, the grapes and lettuce and Gallo. And so that House Meeting outline is considerably different from the blue one, which has had a great deal of material on Gallo integrated into it. With the help of the Gallo farm workers who are down in L.A. and Aggie and the farm workers in the Livingston area, we got a great deal of good information on Gallo, and so that you and everybody else throughout the United States and Canada would have all of that now that we're going into a House meeting campaign specifically directed at Gallo. And that's why we have brought both of them for you to use. And if you remember during my discussion of the history of the Union, I talked quite a bit about Gallo. The main thing that I left out, though, was what happened during the Gallo strike. And Liz and Aggie was there during that time, and I want her to tell you about that when we come back. That is also included in here, but she was right there and was in the midst of it, so we want to hear it directly from her.
Don't you have the tape of what I did at the census?
The tape? No, I don't carry the tape around. Were you going to make me play the tape?
Yeah.
if we can just look at the Greenland, though, for a minute, there are a few things that I'd like you to be sure and emphasize. In addition to the Gallo material, as you're going through your part of the house meeting. As I told you yesterday, each of you will be assigned one quarter of the house meeting. You notice that we've got part one, part two, part three, and part four. And each of you will have a part, will be assigned a part. Before we go to dinner tonight, we'll do that, as a matter of fact. And so in addition to the Gallo material, which I've given, which Aggie will give you more of before we split up and begin to do the house meeting tonight, I think that you can cross out A under part one, background, where it begins, worst emergency in the history of the United Farm Workers and so forth. Cross that out because we aren't, remember I told you yesterday, we aren't using that approach anymore. The party line has changed. and we're not.
Party line?
Yeah. But I do think that it's important now, and I'm talking right now mainly for the people in the field offices. I think it's very important. As soon as you get into the history of farm labor, to mention something that isn't mentioned in here, unfortunately, but the thing that I mentioned to you, that I told you about yesterday, which was the way the land was distributed in the very early days, right at the conclusion of the Mexican-American War, with the Mexican land grants being sold right and left to people over here. And that set the land pattern, the land tenure pattern, the tremendous number of acres owned by individuals or individual families, which in turn set the pattern for the way farm labor was treated from then on right straight through. In other words, it wasn't a family-sized farm pattern. It was a tremendous corporate ranch pattern, factories in the field and all that. You know, now it's conglomerates. So that number B, I think you should hit both that land pattern established by those early land grants and the Pacific, Southern Pacific Railroad, millions of acres that were turned over to them, which in turn resulted in the growers trying to make the greatest possible amount of profit by cutting to an absolute minimum the wages of the workers and all the costs on the ranch by bringing in, always encouraging and always having a tremendous surplus of labor. In other words, that was the pattern. And if we constantly remember that was the pattern that's been followed all the time, the whole thing begins to make sense. And I think that we should also always, in dealing with the farm workers, refer to the ranch nation idea that we talked about yesterday. Do those of you that weren't here yesterday know about the ranch nation idea that we're talking about? In other words, the ranch nation is like another country. A ranch is, Gallo is like another country up there, you know.
It's like a kingdom.
Another kingdom, right, with Gallo, the king, up there on top, and then he's got his own private armies, all the foremen and supervisors, and then the security guards and so forth, and any workers that get out of line and complain get their heads chopped off. It's capital punishment. They lose their jobs, they lose the housing, they lose the transportation, whatever. And the workers, of course, are cleared out the bottom. Well, that's where they are today. Well, for a while, of course, under the contracts, they weren't, I'm getting way ahead of it. But there was a period, as we all know, when they got a taste of something besides slavery under the contracts. And But I think those are the two main things that we want to bring up in there. The formula that the whole system of farming and so forth was based on and is based on in California, and the idea of the ranch nation. The two tied right in together. One brought about the other. You know, the growers' drive for the tremendous profits brought about the whole ranch nation concept, the complete control of the grower over the lives of the workers. And I don't think that we want to spend very much time in talking about any of the immigrant groups that came in. I think they all should be mentioned, and I think we ought to insert the word Portuguese after Filipinos in there and Mexicans. I don't know how we have to leave out Mexicans. But they're certainly a rate more than an et cetera there. And the reason we want to put Portuguese in is because we're going to be talking about
so
Gallo,
wonderful.
You know?
What? It's because they're so wonderful.
Oh, yeah, right.
We needn't be mentioned.
Portuguese.
Right.
When you're talking to farm workers, you know, there's a lot of this stuff that you don't have to explain because they're living it right now, you know. But there's some things that they're very keenly aware of. a lot of things. They're very keenly aware of, but they may not be keenly aware of the tremendous political power, how the growers are able to exercise this tremendous political power. And I think it's important to point that out to them. Because that leads the way towards why it's necessary to be organized, to develop more and more political power, as well as the economic power that the union is developing. And I think that, as we said yesterday, when we talked about that Pixley strike, I mean the Pixley massacre, or Pixley killing during the cotton strike of 1933, which Paul has, have you still got the newspapers about that?
Yeah.
Show it to the ones that didn't see yesterday, Al and Aggie and Elena.
My
very interesting. Huh? You've seen it already? Huh?
Your uncles were there?
My uncles were there.
Is that right?
My uncles were arrested and they were put in the pen.
Oh, they were in jail and they could look across and see it?
Yeah, they weren't there. Luis Rojas and Andres Rojas. In fact, Andres Rojas was, who lives in San Jose, was one of the leaders with Pat
Chambers?
Chambers. With Pat Chambers.
Yeah.
And I talked to my younger uncle.
Yeah.
And he was recalling, and I was asking him about that strike.
Yeah.
I told him, I said, I got arrested in Pixley. Oh, he says, I got arrested there too.
His
There was worse then, he said, because, you know, there was a lot of, like, fear, you know, because of the police and the growers.
Oh, yeah.
And they said that when they arrested them, that they never asked them, you know, their names, or they never booked them. And that there was so much fear that, you know, when they started the shooting, you know, when they killed the farm workers,
yeah,
they were like hauled in a pen there in Pixley. And that people started running and other people just kind of like cuddled in. But the greatest fear was running because that's when the, you know, police really started shooting too.
Yeah. Well, the police shot at the strikers too, huh?
Yeah.
Oh.
But the ones that were running, see?
Yeah.
But the idea was that they were put in that pen purposely. And what happened was that the sheriffs took off. They left them alone. And that's what really scared them.
Inside of the jail?
Well, see, they didn't have them in the jail. He said
they had a kind of a stockade,
like a fenced,
there.
It was a fenced area.
Corral, sort of.
Yeah, and what happened was they split. They saw the sheriffs take off.
Yeah.
A little while later, they saw growers come. And they were armed with shotguns. And they left really so that they could, you know, scare the farm workers.
Just like Gallo's supervisors took off and left the workers out there all alone for the first time. And then the Teamsters came in their limousine.
Right. Right. Some workers said they thought it was a funeral.
So many cars coming out in the road.
Well, it was a... And it happened right in front of the police station there.
In fact, you know what he told me? Just, he said that one guy that was killed, he was the guy that was using the horn. The Mexican, you know, revolutionary horn, you know, that used the blow.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah.
They killed him because they picked him up because he was the one that riled up the people to run into the fields because they used to run into the fields with clubs and everything because they had the scabs in there and he used to be at the end of the field.
Yeah.
The girls are pissed off and he goes,
I got a picture. Did
you have a picture of him?
Yeah.
He said he was the one. He said they made sure they killed him right away. Because the growers were so incensed at seeing him. He kind of like used to stand up on a car, those old cars, you think?
Yeah.
He just to blur away, and as soon as everybody heard that charge, it was like a charge, man, all the way inside, man. And they picked him up, made sure they killed him.
Just remember, don't blow any more horns.
Next thing he knew, Gabriel was blown. Yeah. Well, I think it's good to recall, you know, what the situation is there about the lousy working conditions and living conditions, because they're back. It's back happening to them all over again now, the ones that are not under contract. And in order to get them shaking their heads, you know, well, you can mention a few of those lousy conditions. And it's leading right up to the next section there with Caesar. And I think that I wouldn't spend I've been directing all of this primarily to the field office staff rather than to the service center staff. From here on, I'll be talking to both of you, though, because both of you will be, you know, talking about the founding of the farm workers and Caesar and Dolores and Emmanuel and so forth. And I wouldn't spend much time on the early background or the CSO, except with the service center. You're going to have to tell them more about the CSO because that's the background for the service center.
My uncle's in there.
Huh?
He's in there.
Oh, he is?
Yeah, he's
mentioned,
there.
Huh?
Yeah.
Oh, nice. Being one of those who was arrested?
Yeah.
Yeah. I saw that, Rojas. I just wondered. Yeah.
Did you have any relatives in the southern part of California? There was a Rojas down there leading the strikes down there.
I don't know.
San Diego County
had Rojas about it. They're troublemakers.
Because they're red.
That's right, red. Bunch of red. The more important part, though, for the field office people is beginning there at capital B under Roman numeral 2, the early struggles to organize the workers. I think that needs to be emphasized.
Are you on the second page? Yes.
Page 2, part 2, capital B, the early struggle to organize the workers. And I think it's important to point out the difficulties that, this is at a house meeting, so you're going to have more time to talk than you had at the personal visit. You're going to spend a lot more time with the people during the house meeting than you would with the personal visit. So you'll be able to go into Caesar's and Dolores, the rest of the early struggle to get the workers organized and how they did it and so on.
An hour and a half is going to be, what you said?
Yeah.
Hour and a half meeting?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what page we are, Fred?
On page 2.
Page 2.
Under part 2 there. What I'm suggesting is that the field office people not spend much time on capital A, the brief history of Caesar. They spend a little time, but not much. And spend more time on his early struggles as he begins to organize them in the farm workers. And the resistance that he met from them, you know, from the rest of the people that were not sympathetic, who were opposing him. And then, of course, touching briefly upon the high points of the grape strike, especially when you get down to Shenley, getting down to the firsts in quotes, you know, the first times in the history. Friends, there we were talking about Shenley. That's the first time we went on. We had a boycott. That we tried the boycott out and worked. And DiGiorgio was the second boycott, and the first secret ballot election, which we won. First secret ballot election in the history of agriculture in the United States. And that's the first time we had a confrontation. The struggle of the Teamsters and the first violence on the part of the Teamsters. And then Pirelli Minetti was the third boycott, and the second time we went up against the Teamsters, it was the first sweetheart contract by the Teamsters and the growers. And the first time when we finally won, that there was ever a contract transferred to us after it had already been in effect with some other union. And that's important because of what we're up against, or what we will be up against, when the growers are brought to their knees, you know, right now, or hopefully very shortly, and they have to rescind their contracts or transfer them over to us. Well, I don't know what's going to happen, but I hope it's, I think it would almost have to be rescinding all those contracts, like the contracts were rescinded over in the lettuce, because the contracts are very bad. Teamster contracts, what we know of. We certainly know Gallo's is very bad.
Very bad.
Uh, And then that goes on down. There were victories in each of those cases, you know, on the part of the United Farm Workers. But we still didn't have any, still hadn't made any great inroads into the table break situation. And you remember I told you people were getting very edgy, very restless, and frustrated because they couldn't, and they were beginning to talk all kinds of violence. You know, the same sort of thing that we were talking about the presidency. There was a lot of violence talk around Delano, and so that's why Caesar went on the fast. And which lasted, what, 23 days? 24 days? And did a great, well, probably stopped the outbreak of violence, which could have wrecked everything. And helped, and of course, it helped the whole boycott all throughout the country because it got tremendous publicity all over the country. And then we went on the international, you know, we went on the international great boycott from 68 to 70. You don't have to mention all that stuff I told you about Jamara because that's for your own information, but I don't see any big point in bringing it up. You've got enough material. Connection with what we, in other words, we couldn't win the battle out in the fields because the growers were too powerful. They had complete control of the courts and they got injunctions right away, and then they brought the legals and the other people in to break the strike. But what we have to hit hard are the things that happened or began to happen as soon as we won the contracts in 1970, the benefits, and for the first time, the workers began to get up off of their knees, you know, and to begin to turn that ranch nation pattern around, just to begin to turn the ranch nation pattern around and begin to face the growers, stand up for their rights out in the fields. They were just beginning to do that. And that is a very important point to hit because of what had been happening all during the previous 100 years and what was going to happen again after we lost the contracts and the workers were smashed down to the dirt again when we lost the contracts. Which leads right into the big fight because it was after we got the contracts that the growers really began to fight to try and destroy us. They'd been trying to destroy us before, but not to anywhere near the extent that they tried to after we got the contract. Because that was as soon as the workers began to move and demand their rights out there on the ranches, then the growers began to lash back right away and do everything possible to destroy the union, first legislatively, and when they couldn't get laws passed against the to destroy the union. You know, they tried to destroy it out in the field by sabotaging the contracts. And then finally, by, getting in bed with the Teamsters. And because the Teamsters were interested in the same thing, that was controlling the workers, not letting the workers get out of line. And then finally, the thing that so many of the workers already know about, of course. A lot of them don't know about some of this stuff that was going on behind the scenes. A lot of them do, but I think it's good to remind them of it. And then the final thing, the ripoff of the contracts and the grower-teamster collusion. I think it's important to mention that number C, the Supreme Court decision, because that proves what the union had been trying to get people to believe up until that time. But many people, you know, just said, oh, that's just United Farm Worker propaganda, that there was really collusion over in those lettuce fields between the growers and the Teamsters. Well, the Supreme Court came right out and said it.
And, you know, Fred, I had a debate with Eckers from the Teamsters, Al Salinas. And when I mentioned that, man, there ain't no way they came out, you know, even defended or attacked, man. They just hit them right straight in the face, man.
Yeah.
I mean, they just couldn't say nothing. You know, and just really come down on them, you know, with
that. Highest court in California came out.
That's right, man.
Yeah. On the next part, of course, many of the workers were involved in that strike, but undoubtedly a lot of them weren't, and it was the reaction of the workers themselves to that ripoff of the contracts that they got the strike started, and. Well, it was probably the bloodiest strike in the history of California agriculture. There probably weren't any, there weren't as many people actually killed in that strike, but there were many more people sent to the hospital, and certainly many more thousands of people that were put in jail during that strike than any other that I ever heard anything about. Usually they just arrested the leaders, you know, in the old days. And, you know, they cut off the head of the strike by arresting the leaders. And by this time, they were putting the whole strike in jail. And that...
You know, one thing that's important there, Fred, is that as far as we're concerned, up that far north in California, in the Davis, Sacramento area, I mean, that's pretty wild scene up there. Hadn't it been for all this, hard, you know, I hate to say this, you know, but a lot of education on the police forces about how touchy they're going to be, like how they handle them, at least up to the strike scene. I mean, you know, it costs a hell of a lot of money for a lot of those counties. And, like, during the strike up there, we were able to, like, you know, really get away with a lot of stuff. I mean, and, you know, like, I mean, we could walk into the fields and not get arrested. I mean, mainly because of what
had already happened.
Already, you know.
Yeah.
Mainly because of that, you know.
Blackened their image all
over.
That's
right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. But you see, we can't leave it. It looks very bad if we just, you know, tell them about all the horrible things that happened and then, you know. But we've got to leave it on a net note of hope as we make the transition from the history over into the hustle at the end there. And not only the hustle, first before the hustle, we get into a description of the service center and the various services that are available right while we're having this big national, international boycott going on and a number of strikes going on around California and over in Arizona and so forth. Our service program has continued to go on, you know, and I think that needs to be hit right there, just before you get into the hustle. We have to remind the people that now, in case they didn't know about it, we have all these services, and here's the leaflets, you know, that describe all the services we have, and we should mention some of the services that we think are going to be most, that they're going to be most receptive to, because we're paving the way, of course. For what? What are we paving the way for?
The poor people's union.
And what else? The most immediate thing that we're going to try to get out of them at this meeting. We're at a house meeting, and what are we going to try to get out of the house
more
meeting
house
first?
Meetings?
More house meetings, right. And so we're paving the way for that. It's a tal para qual thing. It's a quid pro quo. We're offering you this, but we expect something in return. The first thing we expect is a house meeting out of you. And we go around, and then from that point on, we start going around the room. And when would you hold your house meeting, Miss So and So, or Joe, or Josefina, or whatever? And we go from one to the other to the other. We aren't just satisfied with finding, you know, the first one. We talked about holding house meeting, agrees to hold it. We go to every single person, try to get, we have four house meetings, we try to get four people there, we try to get four house meetings. If it's five, we try to get five. Well, we don't always get them, naturally. Sometimes out of five people, we only get two people. Well, that's still good, you know. Because with those house meetings, those promised house meetings accumulate. You get two tonight, go to another house meeting tomorrow, you get two more house meetings out of that, well, you're doubling up, you see. But you're keeping yourself busy. You're linking one House meeting with the next, and you're creating a chain into the future. Never ending. So, and then, after you have talked about that, about the House meeting situation, the service center people both groups will be talking about the other programs that the union is in right now. And very shortly, they'll be talking about the legislative program that the union is in, AB1, you know, and we'll need the help of the people, the workers, and also the old-timers when we start getting petitions signed or getting letters or postcards or whatever, or busloads of people going up to Sacramento and so forth. We'll be calling on all these people that we're converting right now to back that legislation. And that will be sort of paving the way, of course, for the legislation that the old-timers want, you know. They need some legislation to help them. And they're beginning to learn, if they don't already know, they're beginning to learn the ways of the politicians by helping the union in AB1. And same way with the farm workers. And so we'll also be trying to involve them, as many of them as possible, going from one to the other, right around the room, find out which ones will be willing to help on, picketing or delegations to call on the liquor stores on the Gallo campaign, or going door to door to pass out our material on Gallo and on the service center, and, you know, all the things that we've talked about. This is the time, this is the payoff at the end of the House meeting. And then we, you know, we also talk about money. Money comes in there, and we try to get, as we said before, we try to get pledges. If we can't get pledges, we at least try to get some change. We try to, you know, sell some Alcriados or bumper strips and so on, buttons. And we're always, as we've said, we're always keeping our eyes open at each House meeting for people who look like they might possibly be good material for full-time workers. We've talked, Alan, whether we mentioned this before, Aggie, we've got to double or triple or quadruple what we've got in the way of staff, or else this thing isn't going to work. So we've got to start looking for it, and Caesar's going to be talking about that with all of you before we leave. And so the last thing that we want to talk to them is about that, and none of them can do it. Maybe they know people that will be willing to come to work full time. And if so, we want to talk to them about it and get the names. And then with the service center people, we'll be telling them within the next 2 months, we'll be calling all the people together to let them decide whether or not they want to have their own poor people's union. So they know that, but they all know right now that they can begin to come down to the service center and get the goodies down there, and so do the farm workers that you're talking to. Only you'll be telling the farm workers that this coming week or next week or whenever you have your meetings, we're very anxious for you to come and attend our meetings, our farm worker meetings. Okay, I guess we better go eat. We're a little late.
And did we come back here again?
Yes.
Uh-huh. But do you think we'll need more light?
I think we're going to need more light in it when we come back.
Won't do me any good. I can't see a thing.
Okay, I'll come on.
Before we went to dinner, we went over the House meeting outline. But in doing that, of course, I didn't talk about Gallo. Because when I went over the whole thing with you first, first time yesterday, in the history, I talked about Gallo in each section of the House meeting outline, except the last one.
Are you on the green,
the blue one?
The blue.
Yeah, I'm on the blue right now. I'm not going to go over the blue with you because I already did that yesterday when I integrated the Gallo thing into the talk about the history. You know, all except the strike at Gallo in 1973. I didn't do that because I knew that. Aggie was coming down. I thought it'd be good if she told us about that because she was right there when it happened. See, she wasn't there when during the early history, but she was right there during that later history. And so, first, when you give your part of the House meeting, be sure and for instance, in the first getting over to the green. General House meeting thing. When you talk about the early background, use Gallo as the example, just like I did. Remember when I talked about the history of Gallo and the way they treated the workers in the early days, and well, the way they treat them now again. But I gave all those examples of Gallo instead of just talking about the growers in general. I talked about Gallo. And I hope you wrote it down.
But I'm sorry, Fred. I didn't write it all down, you know. I think very interesting part of it, but I didn't write it all down, you know.
No, I don't mean all of it. But see, well, you can use this blue part.
But there were at least one good part. I mean, that I was very interested, you know, at the beginning, you know, the explanation yesterday on Gallo meeting, which is that I wasn't aware at all.
Mm-hmm. And so you wrote that down?
No, I did not.
Oh, but you remember it.
Part of it.
Yeah. Well, any parts that you don't, you'll notice that on the Gallo House meeting brochure that we have here, they mention all the things that I told you about.
Yeah.
Right? So that will help you refresh your mind.
Yeah, each of that I didn't.
You find it?
Well, it's a part of the different.
No, each of that when I asked you the question, I didn't read, you know, the whole page.
Yeah. So, in other words.
Also, Fred, can I just mention something? Remember yesterday you mentioned about the labor contractor and some of the farm workers were not covered on that. We were talking about it, you know. Probably at noon.
With Aggie?
With Aggie. Uh-huh. I think she's got an explanation on that.
What's that, Aggie?
What I know later.
Remember this morning when we were talking to you about 90% of the Gallo workers are not covered by the agreement?
Yeah.
What's your explanation?
Well, they don't use labor contractors.
Now?
Uh-uh.
Oh, but they did during the strike, right?
No.
No?
Not necessarily. Not that we know.
Are you positive?
Well, I couldn't exactly swear it. The only labor contractor, we visited all the labor contractors around there, and they all said they weren't going to break the strike. And then one guy came and asked me for money to not break the strike. And he's a labor contractor, but I don't think he took anybody out there. And also, I know that in 1974, of this last strike, that you go, and I'm pretty sure it was true for 73. That you go to the Gallo office there and get your job, and they decide whether they want to.
Now, does this take in the harvest hands, the harvest crews?
Yeah, that's how they do it in.
Well, have you seen the little brochure that compares our contract with the Gallo contract?
Yeah, but I don't remember that part about.
Has anybody got that with them?
It was just back there.
Huh?
It's on the shores.
Oh, here it is.
See, I know Gallo pickers had dues taken out because I saw some of the check stubs.
Mm-hmm.
But they might, if you say that they would.
Now what does this mean? This is on page 9 of the comparison of the Teamster Gallo Sweetheart contract. It says, labor contractors, the labor contractors' supervised employees are excluded from coverage. Therefore, and this is the thing, therefore, all picking crews are excluded.
Does that say that about Gallup Teamster contract?
That's it, yeah. And so, about 90% of the farm workers are not protected. Now that, we shouldn't be having that, and if that isn't true, you know, that shouldn't be present.
I think that's true about Teamster contracts in general, but it just doesn't happen to be true about Gallup.
See, it says Teamster Gallup Sweetheart contract, now in operation.
The Gallup buses pick up at least 80% of the workers.
I know, I'm pretty sure that Gallup was using labor contractors, because this guy, Joe Melendez, from Bakersfield, which is labor contractor, he put a radio spot last year on the radio, soliciting workers to go to work, you know.
During the strike?
During the strike, yes.
Well, listen, I'll tell you, I couldn't exactly swear to you, but like, I know that the Gallup workers that I know that were scabbing last year got paid by the Gallup company. They got taken to work in a Gallup bus or their own cars. We didn't see any labor contractor buses go in there or come out. The person that I know who was helping to get workers for Gallup, who's this big super scab crazy guy, who knows all the Michoacan guys. He's not a labor contractor. He's not a labor contractor. He's a guy that gets people because he knows a lot of people from his land.
What's that word, enganchado or engan?
Enganchador.
Those guys were hooker. No. That's what they used to call it. Something like
enganchador. Yeah, enganchador. They go and contract people, you know.
He may have been getting some money for it, you know.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he was picking grapes.
Let me tell you, you don't recruit scabs unless you get money.
Yeah, right.
That's right.
But
he's a recruiter.
Well, yeah. But he was also picking grapes at the same time. It's not like he was being a foreman.
Still getting some money.
Yeah.
See, Gallup used a labor contractor in 74 in his Clovis operation.
In Clovis?
In his Fresno operation.
Who did?
Gallup.
74.
Oh, he did?
Because he was using Macias.
He was using what?
Macias. Oh. The Macias brothers.
Oh. Well, of course, you wouldn't have seen any of that.
No.
And the only thing you would have seen was what was happening there in Livingston, isn't that right?
I don't know what
and he's got to. He's got properties with workers in, what, three other counties or two other counties or whatever it is?
Yes, in Stanislaus County, Merced County, and Fresno County.
Yeah.
But Stanislaus is in Modesto, it's not very much.
Mm-hmm.
And in the picking, he would take people from the Livingston Ranch over there.
Oh.
See, I might be wrong, but I really think that he wasn't using labor contractors there because he had another system. You know, he had a lot of people wanting to get a job there because he paid higher. See, I don't know, is that true in over there?
Well, if he wasn't paying that good, I mean, why he was recruiting workers, I mean, from Bakersfield?
74, 73.
He was also recruiting workers from Salinas in the newspaper.
Yeah, that adds yes.
In 73, we didn't get enough workers.
When we started up there, they had over 500 scabs, and at one time we had them down to 200.
Where?
Gallup this year. You were there. Yeah, but I mean, the people we seen come in, I mean, the people that we was after is the people from Planada, and those guys were brought in by Gallup buses.
Yeah.
I mean, he had six Gallup buses out every day.
See, I could tell you
if there is a contractor, it wouldn't be the majority, it would be the minority part. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Well, of course, this wouldn't have been based on what happened this year anyway. Would have been based on what happened before. Does anybody know who prepared this?
No. Microministry?
I thought Bob Thompson, but I need to buy a graph.
Because I'm pretty sure that by now, Gallup has one of those books, you know, on his hands, and Gallup will be defending that. You know, Gallup will say.
I know, well, that's why I wanted to get it straight. Because we don't want to be peddling stuff that they can easily refute. And that is such a glaring thing. My God, when you read that, you think, well, what the hell? It's, it really is nothing but a piece of paper if it only covers 10% of his employees.
Well, like when you told us yesterday, man, everybody, yeah. You know.
Yeah?
Yeah, see, it's not true, that, because I see Gallo check stubs all the time. Like, and my friend Lupe that worked in the drugstore was always finding out who the scabs by looking at Gallo check
stubs. Really mean that still
wouldn't. Huh?
Still wouldn't necessarily mean there isn't a labor contract.
Well, it's the same deal as it was before when we were in there. The exact same kind of check stubs, the same kind of deductions. And they get Teamster deductions taken out of their dues.
Aggie, but those guys who work in Fresno, I mean, they don't have to go, you know, to Livingston.
No.
No, but that's just a small operation.
Their main operation.
Yeah, listen to the readings. He says the majority of the workers. You know,
90%?
That's what we're saying.
When you say 90%, it's a high percentage.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think we definitely ought to get this corrected right now, as fast as possible, because, you know, we're going to be in debates with those people all over the United States, well, all over the United States anyway. And so we certainly shouldn't fall into that trap, because we'll just discredit ourselves, you know, by coming out with that kind of exaggeration. So I think we should talk to Caesar to find out who did this.
I think that was David Bursa.
It was either David or Bob Thompson, wasn't it?
Well, nobody is claiming credit for it inside of the book, so
neither one of them are here right now.
Well,
David's gone and Bob's gone.
Okay, what I want to do before we go on to the house meeting and assign the section is to have Aggie tell us about the 1973 strike up there. She was right there when it happened.
Do you want me to do it in house meeting form or just bullshit form?
Well, I sort of, not in house meeting form, because you'll be giving us probably a lot of stuff that you wouldn't necessarily cover in a house meeting.
Tell us the truth.
Yeah,
none of this
house.
Okay,
we can make up the rest of it.
Okay.
You want me
to start?
Yeah.
Just
mention the good parts.
Why don't you come over behind there, Aggie, so you can talk into the mic.
See, well, I came to work at Gallo in May of 1972. And I came to work there originally because I was raised real close to that area and was interested in working with Portuguese farm workers because I had not spoken Portuguese since I was a real little kid, and I'd learned to speak Spanish better than I did Portuguese, and I felt like I would be interested in working with a lot of Portuguese farm workers, of which I'd heard that they were indentured to Gallo. And I heard this from people who went to school at the University of Santa Cruz, who took me over there to check the scene out, you know. And after that, I investigated a lot, and it may have occurred originally, but it was not occurring with people who currently worked at the time that I was there. By indentured, I mean that you would have to work at Gallo a certain amount of years to pay for your passage and the right to come over here. So anyway, when I got over there, I'd been living in Salinas, and I was kind of involved in this thing with La Posada, which was a camp over there where farm workers were really, had a lot of spirit and were fighting for their union. They had flags all over their camp, and they lost the camp and all that stuff. But anyway, there was a lot of spirit. And I got over to the Gallo camps and saw these incredibly depressing-looking camps. I've never seen anything so depressing in my life. In the middle of this huge, really wealthy-looking farm. See, I was raised in this area. When I was a little kid, these were dinky little farms that belonged to Portuguese farmers. And Gallo had, from the period of the early 50s when we moved there to 1972 when I got there, bought out all of this land. It's along the Merced River in Merced County. It's beautiful, really choice land. And he super fertilizes the land so that you can see the difference between the land where the grapes are and, like, say, he doesn't fertilize closer to the road. So the land is it's sandy, a different color. It's not... It's firm looking. He's really done a tremendous job with making turning this into like you know, I don't know what you call a grape bowl or something. But anyway, and in the middle of this, of these two especially, really, really bad camps. And like at camp number one, it was obviously built during the 30s or, you know, before World War II. And like I saw a whole I was out there looking around. There were these whole families living in one room. For example, Basilio Chavez, who was president of the ranch committee, lived with his wife and at least four children in one room. The room had a cement floor. It did not have a bathroom. It did not have a shower. It had only cold water, and it did not have a heater. And he lived there, and his son. There were four small children. In the house next to him was Barbara Serrano Guzman, who lived there with her husband and three children. Another family, the Gutierrez family, had five children lived in one room. And during the picking season, just like all their family would come to live in that room too. So that Jose told me that one time there were 20 people sleeping in it. And that they had to get up in the morning to go and pick. And that Gallo got mad at him for having so many people in there. And he said, well, you know, give us another room because all these people work here. In 1972, when I first got there, in addition to camp number one, which was really, really bad and had this real poor housing, behind it was a row of what they call as gallineras, houses that had no floor, not a cement floor. And they had no windows other than chicken wire. And they put migrant, the picking people in there. In the back of camp number one, there was this old school that had been condemned that Gallo moved over there. And it housed like four families in an old school building. Do you want me to slow down?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
People's going missing.
Okay, I'll go over it again. Okay, I was discussing the gallineras, that means chicken houses.
Gallineros.
And those were torn down. I think they were burned at the end of 72 or early 73. But they were there when I first got there. They had been being used for the people who come during the picking season. Gallo will say that that bad housing, he tried saying this, was used only seasonally. Basilio Chavez and his family lived there 5 years. Manuel Perez and his family lived there 4 years. If you want to even do names, I'll go slower. Jose Gutierrez and his family lived there 4 years without moving. No, in the one-room houses. The gallineras were used for only for pickers. See, and one half of camp number one was used for families, and the other half primarily for single men. But they always screwed it up and always had it mixed up. So that what would happen is in the summertime, when there's really a lot of picking and people get drunk and the single men raise a lot of hell out there, and they'd get into fights with the families about, and you know, it's just a mess out there. And in the wintertime, you have to go to the bathroom. Like camp number one, half of it was shaped in a U, like that, like a U. I'm trying to blackboard. Like a U, and in the middle there's grass. At the end of the U on the two corners up here, say if this is an upside down, like that. Well, up here is, they had a bathroom. Up here, on one corner. And it had, I used to use these bathrooms all the time during the strike. And that was when it really hit me what it would be like to live there all year. Because I used to have to go in there. Like there'd be water all over the floor when you'd walk in there. You know, just because the washroom was in there too. And the doors wouldn't close. And the showers were in there, too. In camp number two, there was one men's and one women's bathroom, but the men's bathroom didn't have any hot water. So the men and women shared the women's bathroom to take showers. And I can remember, this is such an incredible thing. Rogelio Ramirez is this real crazy guy. And Mrs. Antonio Francisco is this old Portuguese lady, you know, standing in the same line. And you know, it was like embarrassing, funny also, but I mean, it was funny at this point because we were all such good friends by then. But imagine what it must have been like to have to live like that and not know each other very well, you know, have to stand out there in your bathrobe with your towel over your head. And in the wintertime, people were always sick because they have to haul their kids down to them, you know, to the bathrooms to wash their hair, take a shower. Most people this is how primitive it was. They had, I don't know the word for it, a polite word, a piss pot in their house. I don't know if there was a polite word for that. I mean, this is how primitive the joint was, you know what I mean?
You weren't primitive, and we had one.
Well, but I mean, considering that Gallo is a month, oh, we had one too. you know. But considering that Gallo is a multi-million dollar operation, you would think that he could afford to put some decent toilets, you know. Anyway, I was real shocked at this whole thing. I thought everybody was going to be, you know, going into the union.
Were the peace pots the real thing or cans?
No, for real, people.
I mean, were they cans or...
Well, I didn't check everybody's out, but most people most people did not get up and go to the bathroom at night, so they would go in their houses, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a real inconvenient scene, like whole families living in one room. Can you imagine? Like, it's what farm workers have always gone through, but Gallo tries to pretend that he was this enlightened liberal who treated his farm workers good. Now, if he treated his farm workers so good, how come up until January 15th of 1974 he still had those camps? You know.
And in 72 he was president of
the Human
RFK
Rights Commission. And of the RFK,
Human
too.
Wrongs.
Yeah. Human Wrongs Commission of Modesto.
He was president of the Human Rights Commission?
Yeah, I'll get to
and
that later.
RFK.
And the RFK. He was on the RFK board.
And
what's
Yow's,
the RFK?
Robert F. Kennedy Medical Plan.
R?
That's our own.
Right.
Yeah.
How did he get in there?
He tried to, he posed as a liberal. Even the people in this union thought Gallo was going to resign.
I think the growers elected their own representatives to be their own, to be the growers representatives.
Yeah, but Gallo did it because he wanted to encourage his image as being an enlightened liberal grower. Isn't that right, Brenda? You know, he was, he always, you know, the kind of things he said was that Caesar was, in fact, they still say that the trouble with our union is because Caesar didn't supervise enough, because Caesar's a wonderful person and the farm workers are a bunch of schleps and they have to be guarded over by Caesar. I think that's in a recent article I read about Julio Gallo.
It's in this.
In Ron Taylor's?
Yeah.
So anyway, that was 1972. And then there was this girl working there named Molly, and she's kind of a peace freak or something. And it was kind of a weird number, and I didn't quite know what was going on there. And finally, she left. And then right after she left...
Where was she working?
In the office at Gallo. And right after she left, well, me and David Burciaga cooked up this scheme where we found out Gallo had really been cheating. We should really use this too, and you should ask David about it. Somebody, you should get David to make a good explanation of it to the boycott, send out a mail out. Because it's an explanation of how Gallo had cheated the workers for years on the peace rate. And he had figured it out. I don't have the brain to figure it out, but he had figured it out.
Very complicated.
And it's fair. Don't you think it's complicated?
Very, very complicated.
Yeah. But anyway, he had really been ripping him off. So we were going to change to the sliding scale rate, right?
Mm-hmm.
So me and David and the ranch committee go in there and we tell Gallo that we have this wonderful new system and that we want to change it. And Gallo said, fine, we'll study it. Meanwhile, you guys just keep on picking like you were doing before and we'll study it. And so the ranch committee and me and David said, or David especially said, well, we can't. He said, if you guys want to study it, well, that's what we let the growers do in Salinas. And they studied it for 8 months, and meanwhile, you know, our workers cut all their lettuce, and then when we finished doing all the lettuce, well, then they didn't change the rates. So we can't, I'm sorry, we just can't trust growers. So either you, you know, either we negotiated about it right now, or we'll go in and work by hours. As one ranch committee guy said, it doesn't matter to me if one goes in front picking and the other one behind him pruning. We'll work real slow out there hourly, right? For picking grapes. So we'll work hours until January here picking grapes. We don't care. So that really made Gallo mad. So then during the dispatch, me and all the people that dispatched, we just told everybody not to work on the day. I mean, to go to work, but to go in and pick by hourly. I thought it was real neat myself. I didn't know it was illegal. I didn't know too much about stuff then. So I thought it was real neat that we pulled off this strike. So on the day of the picking, all the, you know, 360 workers stopped. And it was real, you know, it was real wild. The ranch committee was all freaked out. So I called up here and asked them what to do, and they told me to go tell the workers to go back to work because they were breaking the contract. And so, man, I was real confused about this union. You know, they want you to organize workers, so you organize the workers, and they tell you to tell them to go back to work. So I thought, well, you know, they must know what they're talking about. So I went out there and I told the people they should go back to work, and they started throwing shit at me. Killing and bees and all this stuff. So I went, and Jose Luna was in my office, and he kept making me go and do it. So I had to go out there about 3 times and do it. Finally, Gilbert came, and David, and they had a real good thing to say to the couple. Well, you saw I could go out there and tell the workers to go back to work, and they threw stuff at us.